the second one.
I think it works.
Mr. Stieglitz, the first and maybe difficult this question, is the world changing for better or is it changing for worse?
Well, I guess you asked the question right after the American elections. So I have to say it's changing for the better. I view the elections as, in part, a recognition of the failure of unilateralism, a set of policies that clearly was not good for the way the global economic, the global political system worked, the global environment, objection to global warming, a whole set of policies. But to put it in a little bit longer term perspective, I guess I would say, and this one of the points of my book is that there have been a lot of changes in the last 5 years, say, since I wrote my last book, that are have been positive. It is still clearly a case of the glass being half empty, or maybe two-thirds empty, or three-fourths empty, but at least it's maybe one-quarter full.
What are the positive changes?
Example, for instance, in September, the IMF meetings, there was a recognition that their governance was deficient, and they need to give more voting rights to the developing countries, more equitable voting rights. It wasn't enough. They themselves said it wasn't enough. Hopefully they will do more. They didn't begin to address the problem of how they choose the leader of the IMF. They didn't address the problem of the U.S. veto, but at least it was the beginning. They began to talk about the importance of global imbalances. Global financial instability is really part of their mandate. They should not have been trying to run developing countries, imposing policies that were inappropriate, and moving back to their core function is a positive thing. Again, they haven't begun to look at the deeper causes of the problem, like the need for global reform, the global reserve system, like I talked about in my book, but at least they're beginning the discussion. Global trade. The admission that previous rounds of trade negotiations were unfair and that there was a need for a development round is very positive. The fact that they didn't do anything is very sad. So that's the sense in which you know, 10 years ago, they would never have admitted that there was a real problem.
So there's a new thinking.
Exactly. There's a new thinking and broad-based thinking in you know, many different societies, you know, a global social justice movement around the world, a beginning of a sense of global social solidarity.
But I read your book, and you bring a lot of ideas for institutional reforms, which are necessary if that globalization works. It's a little bit an optimistic book.
Yes.
On the other hand, if at the end the reader asks, is it possible to make these necessary reforms? They are so large, they are so huge ideas that it seems a little bit not very probable that it works.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's really the one question I get. I think the answer is first, one shouldn't think when having to make all of these reforms to make globalization work better. In my mind, it's not black or white. I should have said would not have been a catchy title. It would have been better if I had said making globalization work better, as opposed to making it work. And once you put in this thing working better, you realize it's more of these things we do, the better it will work. Some of them are obviously imperative that we begin working with global warming, but the optimistic note says, look, if we are actually, there's a broad consensus on some of these issues are not a universal consensus. Not going to be easy, but clearly there's momentum. Mm-hmm.
But for examples for an international court to decide difficult trade questions, a new currency reserve system, it's not very probable.
No. Well, first, you pick out on the mm-hmm. international court. I think that as international disputes become more important, mm-hmm. There will be a growing sense of dissatisfaction with the current procedures. Mm-hmm. You know, a relatively small court, relatively few people. Mm-hmm. There's going to be, an evolution. We're just beginning international law in these areas, mm-hmm. and. In other areas, it took maybe centuries to establish a judicial procedures, administrative procedures that we feel reflect and protect mm-hmm. all sides. Mm-hmm. So that's an example where I think that there will be increasingly demand for better judicial procedures. Mm-hmm. Well, again, it's not a question of black and white, a question mm-hmm. of that as they become more important. And they are, mm-hmm. there will be demand for procedures in which more people have confidence. Mm-hmm. The reserve currency one is an example where I don't know how optimistic. In one way of looking at it is, as I say, the dollar reserve system is already fraying. Mm-hmm. You can say that we're going to be moving to a multiple currency system, mm-hmm. euro, maybe euro yen dollar, euro yen dollar yuan. Mm-hmm. Well, as we move in that direction, we're moving towards a global reserve, and it will be easier to move from that multiple system into this single newly created currency. So that's one way of thinking that way we may get there, maybe through an expansion. You know, my main criticism is that if there's only one currency, that currency will be undermined. As we diversify, that problem gets reduced. It still is not as good as doing the system mm-hmm. but it's sort of a halfway house. Mm-hmm. The other point I make is that at the other side, the major savers in the world are already getting increasingly dissatisfied. Savers are in Asia, they say, and they've started the Chiang Mai initiative. Mm-hmm. That's another avenue that could expand into. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of ways that I could see are arriving at what I mm-hmm. talk about. Mm-hmm. I don't know on how long. But clearly, you know, when we think about if you put yourself back in 1920, could one have imagined the end of the sterling system, the gold system, the Bretton Woods system? Mm-hmm. Could one have imagined mm-hmm. the crisis in 1971-73 when the dollar Bretton Woods system fell apart? So the fact is we've been moving very rapidly from system to system. So each time we're in it, it seems like it's forever. But each time we're in it, it hasn't been forever.
Yeah, but the changes often were with a big bang.
Exactly. And the real point I'm trying to make is we'll have another big bang, yeah. and it would be better mm-hmm. if we could avoid the big bang and do it systematically. Mm-hmm. And so the bottom line is that we will be moving out of the current system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We will move out of the current system into something that is closer to what I mm-hmm. described, mm-hmm. but whether we get there in the in a couple steps or in many steps is not clear.
Mm-hmm. The measures which a country which wants to develop has to take need, as you put it, need big government for loans, for borrowing, for innovative businesses. Why can't we trust in markets?
Well, one is, I don't call this big government, because in many ways, it doesn't have to have a government much larger, or it's really a different government. So I don't want to emphasize the size of the government. And that's really the second point. We now have a much better sense of when markets work and when they don't work. And there are a lot of cases where markets don't work. We know that. We've sort of known it for a long time. Markets by themselves produce too much of some things like pollution, too little of other things like basic research. Markets obviously have a problem of distribution of income. No one ever claimed that markets would be lead to socially just outcomes. They just said they were efficient. But we also now know that they're not efficient without certain kinds of government regulations. Nobody believes in free banking. You know, the last experiment was Milton Friedman's experiment in Chile. It was a disaster. Chile is still paying off the debt that accumulated as a result of that disastrous experiment. So everybody believes in government regulations for security markets, for banking markets. We found the problem in the United States and the auditors that were not accountants that were not auditing. So I think today no serious economist would say that free markets by themselves solve all problems. The only question is trying to identify the areas where they're most important to have government activities and the ways in which government can do it most effectively. Unfortunately, you know, and here I do share some of the critics of government, is that sometimes the government's powers are abused, and we see that in, for instance, corporate welfare. The Bush administration talks about free market economics, but double the subsidies to agriculture, protected steel. So there are.
So governments do harm too.
So they do harm too. So it's not like one, you know, somebody said, you know, I have too much faith in markets, in governments always working. And I said, no one who has been in the United States during the last 6 years believes that governments automatically work well. We have seen disastrous government. And if our choice were between that form of government and markets, clearly that people's views would be changed. But that's not the choice that, fortunately, we have to face.
You mentioned already Milton Friedman. Now we can say you're the most influential living economist in the world because he died last night. What's your comment on the legacy of Friedman?
Well, Friedman obviously had an enormous legacy, enormous influence on thinking. Some of the obituaries, like in the Financial Times, I think got it right in emphasizing that it was almost more as a political commentator than as an economist that he had his influence. Importance of a belief in markets versus government. Actually, I mean, he had done very good analytic work. They point out, you know, the work he did in called the consumption function is a permanent legacy, which actually, but in terms of the basic economic contributions, he put forward a lot of ideas that were not as carefully, that caused a lot of problems, let me put it like that. Mm-hmm. And partly because he may have oversimplified, partly because his disciples may have oversimplified. Let me give you some examples. One of the interpretations of the permanent income hypothesis, which was his first fundamental work, was that because consumption depended on permanent income, governments couldn't use Keynesian policy. It was a very anti-Keynesian, because if you temporarily reduced taxes, gave people more income, they wouldn't spend it. Mm-hmm. So it was a very much anti-Keynesian view. Well, that was a view that more recent research showed that, in fact, many people are cash constrained. Mm-hmm. Not everybody. Mm-hmm. And that there are a lot of people, because they're cash constrained, you lower their taxes, they do spend more. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that while the basic hypothesis of permanent income was an important one, mm-hmm. the policy implications was just wrong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, a temporary tax reduction, say like a sales tax, mm-hmm. can induce people to spend money now rather than later. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. well, some people say he proved that government couldn't stimulate the economy, that's actually wrong. Mm-hmm. And more careful work, you know, including some of the work that I did, showed, yes, the government can stimulate. And in fact, with rational expectations, can have even a bigger effect than it can without rational expectations. Mm-hmm. Okay, a second example, monetarism. Mm-hmm. That government should only focus on the money supply. Mm-hmm. Well, people increasingly realize that it wasn't even clear what the money supply was, M1, M2, M0, M3. Mm-hmm. And the boundaries between the two changed over time. Mm-hmm. And today, almost no one believes in monetarism. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, just a couple of weeks ago, Trichet was trying to defend some use of monetary aggregates. It wasn't that he was saying you should use just monetary aggregates. He was saying we should pay a little attention. Mm-hmm. And that shows you how far we've gone mm-hmm. for monetarism, that you have to defend even looking at those numbers. Yeah. The third idea that was abused, I think, was the idea that the vertical Phillips curve, that there was no trade-off between inflation and unemployment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that led people to say, oh, you don't have to worry about unemployment mm-hmm. because there's nothing you can do about it. Mm-hmm. All you do as you seek to lower the unemployment is get more inflation. Again, if you look at it more carefully, that's not a correct interpretation. The fact is that there are lots of policies, like active labor market policies, that can enable you to get that natural unemployment rate lower. Mm-hmm. And we are always in the short run. Mm-hmm. So even if there's no long-run trade-off, mm-hmm. you still have a decision to make about the short run. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that in the long run mm-hmm. there might not be mm-hmm. no trade-off mm-hmm. doesn't mean that there still isn't a trade-off in policy. Mm-hmm. And most fundamentally, I mean, the interesting thing was I had to face this kind of issue when I was in the White House. The question was, should we try to push unemployment lower? Mm-hmm. There were some people at the Fed said, Nehru was 6.0 to 6.2%. We should stop pushing unemployment lower than that because of Nehru. Mm-hmm. I said, absurd. First of all, we don't know that that's the case. If we don't push it lower, we're wasting resources. It's an unstable relationship that we don't know. We still have trade-offs. And we continue to encourage the pushing of that down until unemployment got down to 3.8%, and still inflation did not increase. So it turned out not to be a useful idea at all. You know, we kept it in the back of our mind, but it would not. It was not a useful idea for determining policy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The biggest paradigm of the free market economics is, if I can put it simply, that that you have better results if everybody follows his selfish interest. Would you say this is generally right or generally wrong?
Well, what I would say is that as a theorem, you know, is it the case that Adam Smith's hypothesis that individuals in pursuit of the self-interest leads as if by an invisible hand to economic efficiency? We know that that's not true. And my own research, other people's research, has shown that there is no, that is just not true. Now, what we have accumulated over time is a list of major circumstances in which it doesn't work. And so, for instance, environment, there'll be too much pollution, research, which is the basis of the modern innovative economy, too little research, conflicts of interest. We have CEOs pursuing their self-interest in the accounting scandals of the 90s. Clearly was not in the general interest. So the answer, I mean, so I can't answer your question in a very simple way. Is it generally true or not? I think the way I would say it is that it's an important force, and if we can intervene in the most important cases where it is not true, we can get a better outcome, and that there are an awful lot of those areas.
So you show in your book also that the unjust architecture of the international system serves the rich countries and the poor countries. The question would be, is it really the fault of the West, for example, that Africa is not so good off like Asia is not so good off? I mean, this unjust architecture should harm the Asians the same way like the Africans. Are we to blame?
Well, the way I would put it is the following: it's shared blame. We've made the life for poor developing countries more difficult. An unfair trade regime. 70% of the people in developing countries depend on agriculture. The asymmetric trade has depressed agriculture prices. That lowers their income, makes them worse off. Now, in spite of this unfair system, a few countries have figured out how to manage it. They didn't pay attention to the IMF. They followed their own course. And so, yes, they succeeded in spite of an unfair system. It's a little bit more complicated than that, because clearly the part of the world that is done most poorly is Africa, which has a colonial legacy where they were left bereft of you know, education, infrastructure, political institutions. So the legacy, you can't, you know, at some point you say, well, shouldn't they have gotten over it? But history matters, and history matters for potentially a very long time. And finally, these are, many of the African countries are resource-rich countries. In a chapter in the book, I talk about the resource curse. That's a problem wherever you are. Multinational mining companies coming in, taking advantage of the countries, trying to get the resources, bribing the governments, contributing to the corruption, undermining democratic processes. There's a sense in which their riches are causing their poorness. And I mean, that's sort of the theme of and so, yes, that is a case in which, to some extent, the blame is on the advanced industrial countries now, or the companies in those countries. But I'm more interested, I won't say, I'm less interested in saying who is to blame, as asking, is there something we can do? I mean, I don't want to say who's to blame. Yeah. What is it, 50-50 or 90-10? It doesn't make any difference in my mind.
Yeah.
The question is, are there things that we could do that could help?
Yeah.
And in my mind, I feel very strongly, yes, there are things that we can do that can help. And in fact, not only that they can help them, they probably make us better off as well.
That would be the question, because I think it's totally convincing in your book, as you show how, what can be done, that poor countries develop, have sustainable prosperity. But that does not necessarily mean that not the poor people and the middle classes the poor people and the middle classes in the developed countries profit too. So you just say it on a point. Some people in the poor countries get richer, and some people, especially non qualified in the developed countries, would be come under pressure. That is one reason for this anti-globalization mood we have here.
Yeah, yeah.
How can we can we do something against this, or have to live with it?
Yeah. Well, you can divide some of the reforms into two categories. And one of them are things like getting rid of cotton subsidies. American taxpayers will be better off. 10 million.
But not the peasants.
Well, American taxpayers, 10 million people, there are only 25,000 cotton farmers in the United States. Average income of the cotton farmers is higher than the average income of the Americans. So American taxpayers are subsidizing people who are richer than they are. Most of the money goes to some 15% of the 5,000, 25,000 goes to about, maybe 3,000-4,000 people. So yes, a few people are worse off, but that's the weight is really the benefits of a few against the benefits of a huge number of people. So in my mind, that's a case where it's not like the cotton farmers are poor peasants. And I proposed a reform when I was in the Clinton administration, saying, okay, let's just limit subsidies. No person should get more than $100,000. We're not talking about peasants. Nobody without income of over $100,000 should get a subsidy. That would have gone, I don't know, 90% of the way to doing eliminating all subsidy. Most of the money goes to people who are not peasants, not the poor people.
Maybe that's a bad example of me. But also trade protectionism.
What I want to say is a lot of the things go to special interest. Getting rid of bank secrecy, stronger anti-bribery actions would hurt a few rich banks. And some people who are engaged in tax evasion would be hurt. Money, but people engaged in drugs would be hurt. But I don't care about that, quite honestly. Those are cases where America as a whole would be better off. Europe as a whole would be better off. And the developing countries as a whole would be better off. And there would be a few people who would be losers.
But now,
then the other side is the one that what about globalization, where we trade with, open up our markets with India, China? Jobs are created there. Jobs are destroyed in the advanced industrial countries. And that's what is generating a lot of the anti-globalization movement. There again, it's somewhat more complicated, and the nature of the debate has been changing very rapidly. When that issue first arose, for instance, in 1993, when Ross Perot raised that in the context of NAFTA, said the giant sucking sound, probably, I don't know if you've heard about that here, but he was the presidential candidate, jobs going to Mexico, we said, nonsense. We said, if we run our macroeconomy right, We'll create more jobs than we lose, and we don't want those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
We want high-skilled jobs, and we were right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
NAFTA was signed, unemployment rate was between 6 and 7%. After NAFTA was signed, unemployment got down to 3.8%.
Mm-hmm.
People got new jobs, as old jobs got destroyed. Some people did experience a loss in income.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But overall, you can say there was no stress.
Mm-hmm. There can be a win-win situation with globalization.
Yeah, in that case.
Mm-hmm.
But the more recent experiences have made things more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Outsourcing high-tech jobs to India, you can't say people need to get more education. Now, there's a debate going on in the United States that says, it's not that many jobs. Some people think it's a few, some think it's many. It's too early to tell. My view is we shouldn't be focusing on the number of jobs, because if we run our macroeconomy right,
mm-hmm.
we should be able to maintain full employment.
Mm-hmm.
The real issue is the distribution of income.
Mm-hmm.
And the worry that it will depress wages, unskilled wages in advanced industrial countries. And I think that's a real worry, a real concern.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why in the book I talk about the kind of programs that we need to countervail that.
Mm-hmm.
We need basically three-pronged program, I thought. Productivity enhancing programs, education, technology to increase productivity that will sustain wages, job transition programs, making it easier for people to go to the jobs that are destroyed to new jobs. It's particularly important in the United States, where if you lose your job, you don't get health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third part is what I call a more progressivity, like earned income tax credit,
mm-hmm.
so that people of low productivity can still get a job
mm-hmm.
at a decent wage.
Mm-hmm. Coming to my last question, Eric.
I will take over.
He's from the newspaper Standard.
Okay.
I'm coming to my last question. I found it totally electrifying reading your book, that you are strong in favor, and also in your commentaries of the last weeks, that you are strong in favor of the Chavez reforms in Venezuela and the Morales nationalizations in Bolivia. Conventional wisdom says they are stopping short before introducing communism. Why is it really a model?
Well, what I said is that it is not, first, it's not surprising
mm-hmm.
That people would want to change. The old system did not work for most people.
Yeah.
Two-thirds of the people in Venezuela were in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
In Bolivia,
mm-hmm.
you could not even deal with the government in the languages of the people of the country.
Mm-hmm.
The people who spoke Quechua and the Indian languages couldn't deal with the government. You had to speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Until a few decades ago, they couldn't vote.
Mm-hmm.
Then they said they could vote, but only if they were educated. But they made sure they didn't have education.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one has to understand that historical legacy to say, it is a triumph of democracy
mm-hmm.
that people said we want an other way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's the background.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that you would have elected public officials that say we are going to deliver that seems to me perfectly reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And that they would look at the contract that were signed under previous governments and say those contracts are outrageous
mm-hmm.
is true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anybody looking at those contracts would say those contracts are outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
There's a debate
mm-hmm.
whether it was incompetence or corruption
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and probably some of both. just like in the Bush administration. I think pretty strong evidence that, that there are elements of both. But we don't have to answer that question of whether it was corruption or incompetence.
It's not for the good of the country.
It's not good for most of the people in the country. What these governments are embarked on, or let me put it like, what the these governments say they are embarked on, is another way. Now, there are certain things that they've done that have already delivered on their promises. There are other things where we won't be able to tell for a while. And ultimately, we'll have to, you know, that our judgments about whether these work or not will depend on that. But in the case of Chavez, he's brought health and education to barrios that never had it before. Same thing in Morales. People, there was just a story in the paper today, you know, that a quarter of the population received medical care for the first time ever. I mean, it's inconceivable what has happened. You know, that it's done it so quickly. Both Chavez and Morales have succeeded in negotiating contracts, renegotiating contracts. So they succeeded in getting more of the revenue for their people.
To invest in these people.
Invest in these people. They bargained hard. And they always said, and Morales was very clear, we don't want them to leave. Did they bargain as hard as they could? I don't know. But what I do know is that going from 18% to 82% is a big change, which is what Morales succeeded in doing. And he did it in a way without driving away the companies. And he always said that he did not want them to leave. He was not nationalizing their assets. He always said that in Indian culture, people who own assets need a return on those assets. They talked about how they get a have their land rent system. You know, if I use your land, how I pay you for the land. Made it very clear that he was not out to nationalize one of the foreign companies. So those are I think real achievements, and he's using the oil revenues for the benefit of the people. The hardest question, they are actually trying to get growth investments. You know, will those succeed in getting the economy to grow? I mean, those often take long term. What we know is Venezuela invested very badly in the past. So the standard against which we should compare it ought to keep that in mind. The final point in assessing the success of Morales is one has to understand the difficulties that he's facing. The indigenous people were excluded from government in the past, so they haven't had the experience. They're learning on the job. They have a bureaucracy which is not totally supportive. Many people who were the beneficiaries of the natural resources who don't want to change. So a lot of the establishment is fighting against change. So under those circumstances, even the most experienced of leaders would find it difficult.
Okay, I thank you very much.
If I can just make pick up here.
Yes.
Sure. Why you get? Yes. Okay.